government. And his presentation today is talking about the USI and keeping national training collection records together. Thank you very much, Jason. Please welcome him to the stage.
By the way, is this lapel mic working? Yeah? Good day. All right, we're off and running. Thanks very much for the introduction, and thank you to NCVR for the opportunity to speak to people today, and thanks to Taz TAFE for hosting as well. I had the opportunity to sit in on some of the sessions this morning, and there was some fascinating material presented and some good discussion as well. So I'm Jason Coutts, student identifier's registrar. I have the distinction of being part of the equally smallest Commonwealth agency. It consists of me, but I'm ably assisted by an excellent bunch of people who work for the Department of Education and Training, and we work in close cooperation with them most of the time, as well as in close cooperation with NCVR, and more to that a bit later on. Right. See if I can make this work. Okay, so it's interesting for me today to be talking to an audience that is constituted mainly of, I think, people who are interested in vet research. I've done presentations on the USI usually to training provider groups, and that's great. I like to do that. And we often talk about all of the benefits of the unique student identifier, but there's a strong focus on the mechanical operation and benefits for RTOs in those presentations. And today I'll probably talk a bit about how the USI works, because you kind of need to understand that. But what I wanted to focus on was the implications for research in the vet sector. And so if I rush through some of the descriptive stuff, feel free to come and see me after the presentation, or at the end of today's sessions, and there's plenty of stuff on our website. Also in our, there's a piece in your pack that has a long description of the benefits of the USI. There's one deliberate error in that handout, and if you find that error, I encourage you to contact Saloni Sharan, who's the director of the policy team in my office, and she'll be delighted to have you explain that error to her. But here we go. So as I said, I'm not sure how scintillating a presenter I'm going to be and whether I can even operate this thing. But so I thought I'd hit you with my punchline first. There we go. Just to see if I can hold your interest. So what's the conclusion that you need to draw from that? It's not that I think vet researchers have hairy feet. It's that the addition of the USI to the National Vet Collection will be really unlocking sort of a gold mine of new research opportunities in relation to that really, really valuable data set. So you know the punchline. See if you can hang on to see if I can convince you that it's true. Okay, so a really quick introduction to where the USI come from. Courtesy of NCVR, I learned very recently that COAG was talking about the USI as long ago as 2009. It really got earnest in about 2012, 2013, where approval to implement the system was given, and there was quite extensive consultation. It's interesting in being one of the few bits of underlying legislation for it that's been introduced by both major parties, so it's has bipartisan support in that regard. That went through in 2014. We built the system during that year as well, and turned it on so RTOs could kind of warm up to it a bit, and then the formal requirements for USI to be collected in each instance of a nationally recognised training enrolment applied from 2015. So moving on from there, we now have, 2 and a bit years later, we have over 7 million USIs in the system, and the practical implementation of the initial scope of the student identifier was sort of realised in May this year when we activated the USI transcript service, and I'll talk a bit more about that. So what is the USI? It's two mics. Okay, can people still hear me? Yeah. All right. It's really just a simple. It's a file identifier, like a tax file number or a Medicare number, and its job is to link together individuals' training records in the National Vet Collection across RTOs, across instances of training, across years, across jurisdictions. And many of you would know that the data, one of the characteristics of the National Vet Collection prior to the introduction of the USI, even though names are collected in the process of the vetness, is that they're stripped out before it becomes part of the formal collection. So there hasn't been a firm way to connect people's records together, and that was the principal role of the USI. So people create the USI once, and then that links to each time they undertake training, and that training makes its way into the national collection. So from the student's point of view, they go online and fill out that form on the left-hand side of the screen there. There's about 12 bits of data we collect. Personal information and some contact information. Not all of it's compulsory, but some of it is. You can probably get away with putting about 8 bits of information in. The personal information is to identify a person uniquely. You would be surprised how hard it is to identify a person uniquely. You think a person's name is a person's name, but it's a bit like the old Castrol ad for the older members of the audience. Oils ain't oils and names ain't names. Very difficult to nail someone's name. In fact, the contact details, which we actually collect only to provide confirmation to individuals and to help them to retrieve the USI number, which we found out we have to do a lot, and to also alert them when other people are accessing their data in some instances, are also extremely useful in helping to resolve unique identities between people who look a lot the same. So the main things the students do when they get a USI, they basically open an online account, and the main things they do once that account is open, there's a bunch of them, they can update their details at any time, but the main things they will do is view their transcript. You can see a small version of that on the right-hand side, and they can provide their USI or access to see their transcript to training providers. There'll be no good if I have any surprises in this presentation, because everyone's going to get a sneak preview. RTOs have a similar set of functions they can do, so they can connect to the USI system online as well. They can create USIs for students. About 80% of USIs are created by individuals themselves online. About 20% are created by RTOs on their behalf. About 1% end up having some intervention from the USI office and getting them over the line. That 1% is really important. We want to make it as small as possible. But RTOs can create USIs. They need to verify each time they get a USI from an individual to make sure the name and the person are lining up before they attach a training record to them. They can do that in real time, and a lot of them do it as a batch. The USI basically is built into their student management system, so in some ways it can become quite seamless. It was designed to use as much as possible data that RTOs will be collecting in any case, so that they don't have too much administrative burden attached to this additional requirement. You'll notice they also have a view transcripts button. RTOs can see the student's transcript online if they've been given permission by that student in the student's USI account. Look, that's a new function. We're going to have to work hard to sell them on that, because basically students won't give an RTO permission to see their transcript unless the RTO asks for it. And we've got to get them in the habit of doing that. When they do, we think it'll be very useful to them in terms of assessing things like prerequisites, credit transfers, and the like.
Oh, Oh, there it is. Right. All right. So, as I said, we just launched a transcript service. That screen's just showing some of the information available to students and others about how transcripts work. There's videos and fact sheets and stuff on the website. Have a look at that if you're interested. This is what a transcript looks like in a slightly larger format. If you still can't see it, we have them on the website as well. It basically lists all of the nationally recognised training courses that a person has completed and then all of the units that they have enrolled in and the status of those units. It includes things that they're still continuing in and some other statuses, mainly whether they've completed the units. Interestingly, from a data set point of view, and one of the questions we often get is why can't we list the units underneath the course that they're attached to? But the USI has been added to an existing data structure in terms of a VetMIS and the National Vet Collection, and you can't always connect those courses confidently between the unit and the course at the moment, and so we list the courses and then we list the unit. And also, I just should say, we also, as an indicator on that, for students of the outcome, the date of study, and also in broad terms, whether it's government funded or not government funded. And that's in part to help state training authorities who might be making, and RTOs who might be making subsidy entitlement decisions around people's previous training. Since we activated the transcript service, about coming up to 60,000 people have viewed their transcripts. 10,000 have downloaded them. People can download them, save them, send them as emails to people. One of the things that we had to do when we made data in the National Vet Collection available to the individuals whose data it was is allow for the fact that when you collect 20-something million units of data per year, some of them are going to have errors and omissions. And so in company with NCVR, we had to create a system to make amendments and corrections to those. We figured that some people would think their data needed to be amended when it didn't, so we had a lot of effort went into making sure people understood what should be in their transcript and what shouldn't. So thankfully, we've only had about a couple of hundred of people go to the BART on our system, says what to do if you think there's something wrong with your transcript, which is good. RTOs have been using NCVR's update system, some of them to respond to students saying, I think there's something wrong with my transcript. Some of them RTOs just realising that themselves that there's errors or omissions in their data and making those corrections. So that's been working very smoothly so far. We have no complaints from students or from RTOs that I've heard. Okay. So I just wanted to talk about, that's good, I think I've got at the right point of proceedings onto how does USI work as a tool for research. And I asked a couple of questions. What's the scope? What are the collection rates like? Is there bias in who's got a USI and who hasn't got a USI? How frequently is the data updated? And how do we access it? And I'm going to answer the first four in reasonable detail and leave the last one. No, I'm not. So scope and exemption. As I said, nationally recognised training enrolments and completions from 1 January 2015. So that's all training package courses and all accredited, nationally accredited training courses and subjects. You can call them units or modules if you like. Exemptions are actually very few. Any training that's exempt from being collected as part of a VetMIS is also by default exempt from having a USI, otherwise there'd be nothing for it to attach to. And the graphics around the side of that screen sort of demonstrate the kind of organisations or training types that are exempted from a VetMIS and by extension from USI. So it goes to issues of national security, policing and defence. Also, a number of emergency services made the argument that they don't want to divert resources from saving lives to collecting data, so they're exempt from collecting a USI or a VetMIS, in fact, in relation to their staff and their volunteers. And in some cases, in most cases, that's relatively small numbers. probably with a few of the emergency services, it's a larger number. But overall, we think we achieved the aim of getting near universality in terms of eligibility to have a USI. The other exemptions are offshore training. So any training delivered by Australian nationally recognised training providers offshore is exempt, and that's because we can't create an Australian identity document verified USI for people who are training offshore. International students onshore are definitely included, and there's lots of them, but offshore is not included. There are genuine personal objectives to the USI, people who are worried about privacy and other things, and we made a mechanism for them to express their genuine personal objection to having an identifier attached to them, and so far about 100 people have done that, which is good. The largest group, in a way, of people who are exempt are people who do single-day courses, including nationally recognised training. That exemption is temporary. It was applied in 2015 and extended to 2016, and it's under consideration about whether it extends. It only applies, and 17, I think, it only applies if a student doesn't present the USI and want their data recorded. And it takes account of the fact that in a single day, if you have a problem with your enrolment, including getting a USI, and you didn't want that to, and particularly the RTO, didn't want that to hold up them finishing their process with their student handing them their certificate. So RTOs delivering single-day courses are allowed to award qualification to a student without having collected a USI from them. Cool. All right, so I thought with the research group I should have some charts, and I thought if I had a chart there should be... How long have I got? 5 minutes. Wow. All right, I'm going to rush now. All right. That means I can rush over that slide that has a mistake in it. And this slide, which also has... No, I'll do them both. All right. This is what happens when there's a tragic collision between an infographic and an actual graph. So the scale on the left-hand side doesn't match the actual data that we're trying to present. What I was trying to say is in the first year of collecting the USI, we had about 75-80% of cases where we collected the USI for what we defined as eligible training. It's quite difficult, actually, to define eligible training. 90% plus where... don't take a photo of that one. It's got the mistake in it. Especially you. Right. So that wasn't too bad for a first go. In the second year, that's only three-quarter data, and it's only the stuff that comes through state training authorities. But it indicated a big pickup in collection rates, both for all enrolments and particularly for where a qualification was issued. We think that that'll be borne out in the full year data, which will be available soon. The things that have changed and helped bring that to pass, and I think we'll edge all of it back up towards 100%, I don't think we'll ever get 100%, is the fact that RTOs became more familiar with the USI as part of their processes, finished the process of adapting their student management systems. NCVR has applied some more clever validation. A notice went out from regulators to all the RTOs who didn't comply very well and convinced them of the seriousness of data collection, and also we did some things with our system that make it easier for students to get USIs and for RTOs to find them on behalf of students. So I think that's all pointing towards us edging up towards 90s and beyond for USI coverage for national recognition. Oh, okay. I wanted to quickly talk about whether there's bias. One of the worries was whether disadvantaged cohorts who might have lower access to forms of ID might not be able to get USIs, and therefore the data would skew against them. Those are the forms of IDs that you can use to create a USI on your own. About 98% of USIs are created using those IDs. But we allow RTOs to help students, and my office will help students who don't have those forms of ID that are just linked to national databases to use any of that very long list of things to make sure you can get a USI yourself. So nobody goes home without a USI. How often is the data updated? It's updated in line with the national data collection, so that's basically annually for direct submitters and boards of studies, which fee-for-service training in general. State Training Authority data, which is mostly the subsidised data but includes a little bit of fee-for-service as well, comes in quarterly. So the USI will be updated annually for some training and quarterly for other training. And the first quarter data for 2017 we hope to have up before the end of this month. That's a very simple process by which the data finds its way into the national training system, because someone will inevitably say, when are we going to move to having more data more quickly? That's some of the reason why it isn't as easy as you might think. Okay, so the hypothesis was, what is the USI a gold mine for vet research, or is it just another revetness field? It's both is the answer. It's just, whenever there's anything wrong with it, I say to Craig, it's just another revetness field. it's your problem. But what it does do is it unlocks all this massive data in the National Vet Collection. And what I wanted to do is, it's about, there's great research that happens in that already, but this is about taking it to I'll quote the Prime Minister, it's never been a more exciting time to be a vet researcher than now, because you have total vet activity and you also have the USI to link individuals together in terms of this wonderful data set. And what I'd encourage you to do is fill your boots. There's some great longitudinal data that you already have, but this is a new way to unlock interesting things. You don't have to wait 5 years. There's things that you can do using USI right now. And I guess I encourage you all to think about how you can use this data element to improve the operation of the National Vets. Before I finish.